Oh, I'm
Censored. Okay. So first of all, thank you so much for the invitation. It's a real pleasure and privilege to join you. And it's wonderful to see the familiar faces. Looking forward to getting to meet the unfamiliar faces so far. And thank you to Tamara, thank you to Bella for putting this project together. It was beautiful to take an opportunity at Yom HaAtzmaut. It's not just a day about flag waving and celebrating, but it's also about true and deep religious appreciation of what we have to be thankful for. And so on this Yom HaAtzmaut, I want to just really deal with one issue which has intrigued me for a little while in the last 2 months. And a little bit of research I did on it, and I want to just share that with you as you try to expand upon a topic which is really important. On Purim, no less, this was this year, I believe it was March 21st, I was at somebody's house delivering Mishloach Manos. Somebody leans over and he says, "Rabbi, have you seen what Donald Trump just said?" Now, he does a lot of tweeting, okay? So there can be, what he tweets could be really anything. But he leans over and this fellow shows me, he says, he just released the following tweet. I actually put the tweet into the sources. Page one, this is his tweet. "After 52 years, it was time for the United States to fully recognize Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights, which is of critical strategic and security importance to the state of Israel and regional stability." Exclamation point. There are 140 characters, we have to use them, right? So this set off a revolution of responses, celebrations, and demonstrations, and everything in between around the world. Of course, immediately, the UN Human Rights Council set up an emergency meeting to declare that the Golan Heights was not Israel's territory, and they were violating international law, just to set the record straight. The security meetings and emergency meetings are only really ever set up because of Israel and terrifying emergencies like Donald Trump allowing America to recognize its right to the Golan Heights. Let's try to appreciate what's going on over here. Just the significance. It happens to be that Shabbos was, we had an offer in Shul, it was 2 days later, it was a Thursday for him. So in Shul happens to be the fellow who's getting married was a nephew of David Friedman. David Friedman does it at our shul. So I said, "David, shkoyach on the Golan Heights thing." And I said, how involved are you?" He says, "I dictated the tweets." So I was like, "Okay, good." So it was really a Shabbos of celebration. It was a beautiful opportunity to celebrate this. And I wanted just to get a little bit of background because there's a lot of confusion about this. I am by far not an expert in international law. I hope that some of you should be going into that at some point in time because we need to have more voices of reason in that arena. But just to appreciate a little bit of background over here, why everybody gets so hung up in this business, is up till really essentially the 20th century, how did countries become countries? Like, how did France become France? How did Germany become Germany? What happened? Yeah. Yeah, so it's called the right of conquest. Basically, if I have a big army, I just march in, I take over, I put my flag down, and now all of you will pay taxes to me. And that's how it works. And that's how countries were formed. That's how states in this union were formed, right? So there were trade deals and there was conquest as well, let's be honest. And this is how countries were formed, essentially, over the time. It started with small groups of people, then turned into hunter-gatherers, and then turned into nations. And nation-states expanded their territories depending on how powerful they were. Great. It wasn't so great at the beginning of the 20th century because two things happened in the 20th century that made people think that this might not be the best way of facilitating countries creating themselves. And what were those two things? They were so big and so terrible that they made everybody rethink things, and they were called the World Wars. Because what happened was, is now suddenly you have countries expressing that right without bounds in any way whatsoever. So that means to say, you have countries like Germany, England, France expressing their colonial interests. So for instance, in World War I, looking at the Ottoman Empire, which is devolving, and seeing as it falls apart. And as they do that, they're trying to say all the colonial countries have interests in this plot of land. When Germany, both in World War I and in World War II, sets its territorial expansions and then conquers all the way up into France, the world realizes this business is not working so well. So they start setting limits. And the League of Nations, which is the precursor, almost equally as useless as the UN in many rights, the League of Nations, which is set up after World War I, sets up a mandate as part of their charter in 1919. And in it, they have they basically say that the right of conquest is no longer. The right of conquest is no longer. Are there any extras? I think we just ran out. Oh, they are over here.
going to go as well.
Okay, so we have maps here, and there's probably some sources floating around as well. So basically, at this point in time, the League of Nations says no longer. In the 1928, the Kellogg-Briand Pact essentially formalizes this and is voted into effect in 1970, I think it is 74, by the UN in a particular resolution. And that becomes the rule of the land, that basically let's freeze frame all of the countries. We're going to keep the status quo, and anybody, I have to practice really hard, man. I say status quo. Okay, so I'm really trying, because you'll recognize those moments where I'm going to translate. Okay, so they freeze the status quo, and they say any country who's going to violate the status quo is essentially is an aggressor. Any act of aggression will be treated as violating international law. And that's fine and great when it comes to Europe, because Europe more or less is kind of the same, right? We all agree, right? Most of the countries are set up. Germany is a little bit of a mess after it was divided into four parts after World War II. Okay. But besides that, most countries are kind of stable. The problem is in the Middle East, it doesn't work like that. It's so easily. And the reason it doesn't work like that, let's just think about this. Why is freeze-framing the borders of a country a problem in the Middle East in general? Just saying, this is it, and you can't change it? Because they're all new countries. What are the countries in the Middle East built based on? Meaning, like, who decided the borders of the countries in the Middle East?
European
colonialists. Meaning, in 1916, during World War I, there was what's called the Sykes-Picot Plan, in which the French and the British arrogantly divided up the Middle East. And they said, the French said, you know, we'll take those two countries. We'll take, you know, what they became Syria and Iraq. And the English said, we'll take the Palestine country, right, that whole area. And they divided up. It was international territories. But it was basically arrogant colonialists in Europe dividing up the Ottoman Empire. So they created these boundaries which didn't recognize the rights of the indigenous nations. Give an example of one indigenous nation which has been overlooked through the colonial boundaries in the Middle East. Very obvious example. Still to today, they're not recognized, and that is the Kurds. Think about the Kurds. There should be a country called Kurdistan. There isn't. There are Kurds who are both in Turkey and in Syria. And any time the Kurds vie for a national state, they're automatically either repressed or killed or quelled. Right? Think about the double speak of Turkey and Syria talking about a natural country expressing self-determinism. It's really interesting to hear when they support Palestinians' right to self-determinism, but not Kurdish right to self-determinism because they're the minorities in their country. Just thinking about comparison. So when we created these colonial boundaries suddenly, freeze frame it and say, okay, deal with that. Stay. Anybody who steps over that line, which is a sort of an arbitrary line, is now going to this armistice line, it's green line, whatever you're going to call it, is now violating international law. More complicated, right? Also, what happens when you have two groups of people in one territory, and one group says we've always been here, the other group says we've always been here, we have ancestral rights, each one denying, well, not denying in one direction, but there's a lot of quibbling about ancestral rights in this territory. And now you're going to say, anybody who steps over this boundary in a volatile hotbed is going to be an aggressor in international law. More complicated, just to say freeze-framing it, right? So that's why when 1967 happened, and Israel fought back against the bombardment from Syria and takes the Golan Heights, it's more complicated. If you look at any map today, even the State Department's map still, just to should be aware on, if you Google map, Google image the maps, you'll still see the Golan Heights now is labeled as, what's the actual name of the territory? It's called? What's the label on the map? It's not Israel. It's called? Any map you look at right now will be Israeli-occupied Golan. That's what it's called. Meaning, really, whose is it? It's, by international law, really, Syria. Because Israel conquered it from Syria, and Israel was seen as an aggressor, even though Israel, actually in self-defense, fired the first shots of the war. Even though the act of war was Egypt crossing the Straits of Tiran, yet as it may, Israel is the international community has not yet, until March 21st of this year, recognized that Israel has the right to the Golan Heights. And this is why Israel's conquest came in the wake of a much more complicated history. So that's kind of where we're sticking at. My problem is like this. Is like, to be intellectually honest people, in order to be able to appreciate something, you can't freeze-frame colonial boundaries. You need to get back into context. You can't sort of break up the fight and say, okay, children, you keep this toy, you keep that toy, because it just might be that the bigger kid has the one toy at the moment that you split them up, and that's not really, they don't really own it, right? So you need to really understand who owns this? Who brought this from home? Where did it come? Is this from your house? Is it from your house? Did you trade? Did your mommy know that you brought it to school, right? Ila have deal, right? So you need to understand context. You can't just walk in there and a superintendent mandate what each kid is going to be doing. Lahavdil. So now we're coming to the Middle East, much more complex. Let's try to understand context. Do we have a right to it in the first place? That's the question. That's the question I like to address. Do we have rights to the Golan Heights? Okay. So just by fingers. Yes. Do we have rights? Ancestral. One finger is yes. Two fingers are no. One finger yes. Two fingers no. Do we have ancestral rights to the Golan Heights? Just by a show of hands, about voting. Yes or no. Okay. Yes or no. And diplomacy doesn't work here. Don't worry. It's not a problem if you're right or wrong. Yes or no. Okay. I have lots of yeses and no's over here. Okay, no's good. Yes, no's okay. Very diplomatic, some of you. Okay, good. No comment. I hear that. Okay, so let's try to delve down in this. Because, you know, when you hear the word Golan Heights, it sounds like a modern term, right? It sounds like something which has been invented in the last 70 plus years. And you know, do we have biblical precedent for it? So let's try to go back. Let's go. And what we're going to do is we're going to do a quick survey. Quick as because we're going to go from a few thousand years of history very, very fast. Okay, so hold on to the seats. Let's try to get through here. First stop on our train is to understand what was it part of the promised land? We call Israel the promised land. Why is it called the promised land? Because it was promised. Good. By whom to whom? Hashem to? Good, thank you. Good. Okay, good. Most people start with Israel when they start with Yahushua. That's not what happens. You need to go back to the beginning because context is everything. What does Avraham Avinu get promised? Okay, this is the promised land. Let's take a look over here in the sources. If you have it over here, by the way, just put in the maps of where the Golan Heights is today. If you take a look on the second page of the source areas, you see the Golan Heights. It's essentially the right embankment up above the northeast border of the Kinneret. Who here has been to the Golan Heights? Just out of interest. Okay, good. If you haven't, go. It's really an incredibly beautiful area in Israel. And it's of extreme strategic importance, especially when all the neighbors are terror sponsors or state sponsors of terror. So it overlooks Syria in the, going to the north, it overlooks Lebanon to the west, and it overlooks the Galil in the south, an incredibly important part of the country. So now, this is what Hashem says to Avraham Avinu in source 1. Be'yom ahu koras Hashem es Avraham bris neymor, le'zaracho nasati es ha'aretz ezos, I'm going to give you this land, minahar Mitzrayim ad nahar agadol nahar pras, from the Nahar Mitzrayim, the river of Egypt. What do you think that could mean? Possibly some part of the Nile, right? The river of Egypt, the Suez, not invented yet. Okay, and the Nahar Gadol, Nahar Pras, what's the Pras in our terms? Euphrates, right? So that's pretty deep. That's pretty deep north, okay? Esakeni, Esaknizi, Esakadmoni, Esakhiti, Esaprizi, Esarifoyim, Esamori, Esakani, Esakikoshi, Esakikosi. How many nations is he promised? Ah, you see, you didn't count. Most people say it's the seven nations. There's 10. Right, so there are the seven nations of Canaan, but there are the extra three. The first of those were the Kani, Knizi, and Kadmoni. Those are the ones which are the we'll call the ultimate promised land, expansive territory. Did that happen? Not clear. If we're getting that, it sounds like that's something for the future. What does that actually look like? Okay, so let's get a sense of what that actually looks like. Now, this is why we have the maps over here. So if you have the maps, take a quick look. If you don't have, there's a few extras over here. The reason why this is important is it's important to see what we're talking about. These maps are all copied from the Da'at Mikra Atlas. I'm sure we've all seen the Da'at Mikra. This is like an example of one of the Sifrei Nach. It is a academic Pirush on Tanakh from a Torah perspective, which is a unique symbiosis of this. There are a few extras over here if anybody needs over here. And what we're going to be doing is the following. Is we're going to look at, although they have many maps and many archaeological finds in the actual Tanakh itself, they have a separate sefer called the Atlas. It's in Hebrew and in English. It is really worthwhile if you have a chance. It's expensive, but it's worthwhile because you can actually see everything from start to end. It is really remarkable. Here are some of the maps which are relevant to us. You'll see by the page numbers that this is just really a mere selection of the maps. You know, the last maps on page 319, we're starting on page 47, so this is just a small selection of the relevant maps to us. Let's take a quick look at this. Let's charge in. So if you look at this map, it's a little bit hard to see depending on which kind of copy you have. Actually, your copies are better than mine. They use yours. And you'll see that this is the land of Israel, and there is a dotted line in the middle of the Sinai, right? Towards the edge of the Sinai. That is Nahar Pras. That's the edge of what's called the Wadi of Egypt, one of the tributaries of the Nile, which is mid to edge of the Sinai Peninsula. And then all the way north, you see there's a dotted line by Hor Hahar on the coast there. That's very, very far north. That's by the Amanus Mountains. That is essentially northern Lebanon, really coming in towards Turkey. Okay, so the promised land, based on this account, is huge. Huge. This is much bigger than Israel today. And this is what Avraham Avinu was promised. But truth be told, that is not exactly what happened. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to put the promise land on hold. We're going to try to see what reality is. What does Hashem actually promise to them or give the nation of Israel when they are about to enter the land of Israel? Now, we need to do this in two steps. Okay, so first we have Avraham Avinu's promise. We'll call that projection mission, right? So mission statement is Avraham Avinu's God. When that mission happens is not clear to us. It doesn't have to be that Avraham Avinu is going to get it right as the Jews enter the land of Israel, right? It could be that that's in the future. Okay, but we have at least that mission. Now, what actually happens? So, the Jews are waiting on the banks of the Yarden. They're in the area of Jordan right now. This is the steps of Moab, what it's called as they wait, and they're about to enter the land of Israel. So we're on East Bank Jordan right now, and Moshe Rabbeinu is now told the following. This is in Midbar Lamed Daled. Here's what Moshe Rabbeinu is told. Take a look at source 2. This is on the third page. Here we have it. By Midbar, we are told that he's getting the whole border. And for us, we're just going to focus on one border, and that's the northern border, because the Golan Heights, of course, is in the northeast. So we're just going to focus on the north. There's lots more to think about. But just for right now, in Pasuk Yud Dalet, Yud Aleph, it says, V'yorad ha'gvul misfam ha'rivma, mikedem la'ayin, V'yorad ha'gvul umacha akasef yom kineret kedva. So actually, just to reversing a few pesukim, we're not going to read them inside, but the border starts from Hor Ha'har, works its way eastwards across and descends down past all these cities. It goes from Rivla to Ayin and goes down to the Kasef Yama Kineres. What does the word Kasef or Kesef mean? In this case, the Taf, not with the Samach. Kesef usually means good, shoulder, good. So it's usually understood as the shoulder. So what is the shoulder of the Yam Kineret? So you can imagine the border is going down. If we have Israel and the border is going down, it's hitting Kineret, but this is on the shoulder of Kineret. So there is a really interesting article which is written by Rav Chagai Elitzur on virtual based medrash, VBM, and he goes into proving that there's another two times in Tanakh the word kesef, shoulder, is used, and it refers to a adjacent piece of land which is a little higher. What do you think it could possibly mean in this case? Is most likely is the Golan Heights, which is the elevated land just on the kesef, just on the shoulder of the Yam Kineret over here. So meaning, when Moshe Rabbeinu, again, it's a little bit of guesswork here because we don't have the specific name places that they had at the time of Arvois Moab. But nonetheless, when describing this, Moshe Rabbeinu describes the northern boundary going from Hor Ha'har across, getting to a place called Chatzar Enan, coming all the way down to the shoulder of Yam Kineret. Great. And this is supposed to be the land which they're going to get. There is a great debate in the Mefarshim. Is this the same as Avraham Avinu or not? Is this the same as what Avraham Avinu was promised? Avraham Avinu had this huge territory. Is this the same, just different terms? Or no, it's actually more, it's a little more, we'll call it subtle, a little more limited. So just to get a sense of what it may look like, over here, you take a look on the next page, the figure 2, this is the promised land versus the land of Canaan. The possibility of this in the more limited version is that Mount Hor Ha'har is actually much lower. You take a look in the map over here, you will see it is certainly higher than Sidon and Tyre, Sidon and Tyre, but it is still about midway through Lebanon and the northern border coming down, encircling the Bashan Hills, and the southern border, of course, is also only to Kadesh Barnea, which is not even to Eilat. Okay, so just to appreciate this. It may be that the land which Bnei Yisrael are promised as they're about to enter the land is a little more limited than the land given to Avraham Avinu, and there's a machlokes in the Mefarshim as to if it matches or does not match up with Avraham Avinu. So does it. This is all theory right now. Why is this theory? Because heaven is the land. What actually happens is going to be different to the theory. Let's hit practice now. What actually happens in practice? So a few things differ from theory to practice. One, the first thing that differs is what changes. Just before even checking this out, what changes from the movement, from the ideas of Moshe Rabbeinu and before him Avraham Avinu, and now the practice. What changes? What changes in action? Ready?
Timeline,
good. So how long it takes to do that?
The time in the desert is like still, and like a brand new nation being the one to come in.
Okay, so you're right, but you're talking ideologically. I'm talking about practically. Boundaries. What changes boundaries? You're right. I'm trying to say, so practically speaking, the vision of Moshe, the vision of Avraham, how did that change when they actually walked in to the land? Did they reach these boundaries? Did they not reach these boundaries? Did they reach some of these boundaries? That's the question. Yes.
The fact that half of Menashe and
okay, that's an interesting point. That's a great point. That's a great point. So first of all, we have tribes who wait behind. What else? Any of your comments? Yeah.
Maybe also who you're able to kick out.
Yeah, who are they able to kick out? Do they kick out everybody? Maybe not everybody, right? So let's take a look at both those possibilities just for a second. First thing is that changes is, let's come back to the Trans-Jordan tribes, right? So you have a whole bunch of tribes who arrive on the east bank of the Jordan. They say, hey, we have sheep. This is fertile pasture. This is part of the Fertile Crescent, isn't it? It's on the banks of the Jordan River. Looks wonderful. We have sheep. It's pasture. I can see myself sending down my family. I could envision a nice ranch in the corner over there. Fantastic. Moshe Rabbeinu, would you mind if we stay there? What are the tribes who ask? What are the names of those tribes? Reuben and Gad. Not Chatzi Shev and Asher. They did not ask. Reuben and Gad asked to stay there, and Moshe Rabbeinu was a little bit resistant. But Moshe Rabbeinu says, doesn't make so much sense, because what's going to happen? If I let you stay, what's going to end up happening? So not it was that could be one issue. But Moshe Rabbeinu was more concerned is, you are now essentially depleting the Israeli army by 2/12, right? Because you're going to now settle down while we all busy fighting wars. So Moshe Rabbeinu made an ironclad commitment from them that they're going to come in, they'll fight with them, and then they'll come back. And that's what they did. That's exactly what happened. And Moshe Rabbeinu allowed Gad, Reuven, and Chatzi Shev Menashe to settle on the east bank. Why Chatzi Shev Menashe? They didn't ask. You go to Pesukim in Parashas Maaseh, they did not ask. That was not part of their request. Why was Chatzi Shev Menashe in this area? They were not part of the request. Troubled in Parashim for a long time. Why it is? I was once in Gush for Shabbos, and I had the opportunity of hearing from Rav Yoel Ben Nun, and a pre-Mincha Shir, he said the following suggestion, which is, I think, is remarkable. We know that the tribe of Menashe, and specifically Yosef, is a land which is a family which is Mechabev Eretz Yisrael, which deeply desires and appreciates the land of Israel. And we see this many times. So, for instance, the Benos Tzlavchad as one example. There are many times the Bnei Ephraim actually left Egypt before Exodus and tried to attack Israel, actually ended up dying. There's a lot of interesting episodes where the children of Yosef really deeply desire the land of Israel. And so therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu said like this, you know what's going to happen? You know when you have tribalism, you have different states, and you put two of them on one side of the river and the other on the rest, you know what's going to end up happening? Cessation from the Union. Listen to New Hampshire and California every 2 days, right? Like, we're going to make our own country, right? So think about this. So Moshe Rabbeinu says, how do we keep a unity? How do we keep the Union in check? How do we avoid civil war? How do we avoid a war in values? What we need to do is we need to create a land bridge. So you create a land bridge with one tribe which loved Eretz Yisrael. That was Menashe. So you used a common, that would have to be a highway, that would be commerce, that would have to be relationships, families, right, the whole business. And that would ultimately keep them connected to the mothership. Very fascinating argument based on some fortune. Really remarkable perspective into why Chatzi Shev Menashe was thrown there. Another option is that no, maybe Chatzi Shev Menashe was always supposed to be there in the top northern quadrant. Why is that true? Well, we actually see the area that they inhabit. Because let's think about this. Who used to be on the east bank of the Jordan? Who used to be there before the nation of Israel settled there? So we know that the Ammon and Moab there, we didn't touch them. We didn't touch Edom. We weren't allowed to. They're all family, right? Family protection. But the people who are not family were, what are the names? Do you remember? Two kings, two territories, Amorite kings. Their names were? Sihon and Og. Sihon had a large territory, which is where Jordan is today. We conquered that. Parshas Chukas. That's where we see it happening. And then we also conquer the land. The very end of Parashas Chukas talks about conquering the land of Og, Melech HaBashan, the king of Bashan. Where exactly is Bashan? Well, we actually know, which is fantastic. So take a look at the same map you're looking at a second ago, figure two. This is the promised land of Canaan. Take a look at next to the Kinneret on the right hand side is the Bashan Hills. Right? The Bashan Hills is essentially what we call it today, Golan. Right? So that particular area is where Menashe was settling down. Chatzi Shev Menashe was settling down. That was his connection. It could be that was the extent of the continuation of Israel. It's not Transjordan because it's above the Kinneret, so to speak. So it might be that was originally his territory. Either way, the idea is that we now have an easterly settlement of the nation of Israel already, which goes as far up as the Bashan Hills. Bashan Hills is where we have Golan today. Yes.
This is saying that was not where
Reuven
and Gad were.
Reuven and Gad were south. Reuven and Gad were next to the Dead Sea, going all the way up to the Kinneret, essentially. And it sounds like Menashe's section of the Transjordan was in the further north area.
So the suggestion is that the top of Menashe were in originally designated Eretz Canaan versus
correct.
Reuven and Gad.
Because the Moshe Rabbeinu's promise was, or included this, according to the way we map out the territory. That might be the Kasef or the Yam Kinneret already. So it's a debate as to whether this was Transjordan tribes getting their territory, or was original promise, as Moshe Rabbeinu says it. Either way, it seems to be the land of Canaan that we conquered, and the nation of Israel walked into. So Either way, it comes out to the same point. By the way, where does the name Golan come from? Hint, it does not come from getting on the shuttle and going up to the YU campus. Right? As one of us, we love the Golan. The reason is because it was one of the names of the Ari Miklat there. Take a quick look at the source 4. Right? So when Moshe Rabbeinu is on the Transjordan, he separates 3 Ari Miklat. And in the Pasuk Mem Gimel, there's Betzer Bamidbar Be'eretz HaMishar, the Ruveni. There's Ramos Bagilad Legadi. There's Golan Babashan Lemenashim. Golan was the name of the Ir Miklat in the Bashan Hills for who? For Menashe, because that's where they were. That's where they lived, right? So that's where Golan comes from. It happens to be that we adopted that name, but it makes a lot of sense because that was the territory. By the way, as a fascinating side, just for homework, it is fascinating that on Transjordan, where there are only 2.5 tribes, we have 3 Ari Miklat. In Israel, where we have 9.5 tribes, we have 3 Ari Miklat. That's a bad ratio, right? So the ratio should have been much less on Transjordan. The Gemara discusses why that could be, since we have been a homicide problem on Transjordan. Be it as an A. Okay? So this seems to be what's happening over here. We have this area called Bashan, this capital called, or this Ir Miklat called Golan, that's the name of it as we have it today. Was it part of Israel? Answer is absolutely. Absolutely. It was part of Menashe. The only thing is there's a little bit of ambiguity over here. And that is that when it comes to actual conquest, so we've mentioned just beforehand, I'm sorry, I don't remember your name. I've been catching that actually. Yes. Yitzhar. Yitzhar said it's a very interesting thing, and that is that we actually, when it came down to practice, we didn't actually do the conquest so well. Here's why. We have, if you read the first section of Sefer Yoshua, basically to Perek Yud Beis, always worthwhile to learn Tanakh, because it's all there. So in the first 12 parakim, it talks about conquest. Sounds phenomenally successful, king after king. And in fact, the end of Perek Yud Beis talks about the 31 kings that were conquered. Not 31 countries, the way it used to be, there would be fiefdoms. It'd be like a king who could be controlled all the fields around them, all the vassal states and all the villages. When you conquer him, that all falls, right? So 31 territories essentially conquered of Amorite and Canaanite kings. Great. And you think to yourselves, pat on the back, we've done so well, fantastic. The problem is, Perek Yud Gimel Yoshua starts off with the following. Source 5. Yoshua says, Yoshua zakein baba yamin va yomer Hashem elav, atoz vakanta be'ol basal yamin va arz nisharo harbe ma'od rishta. Yoshua, good job, but the land still remains primarily unconquered. Right? And what was the areas that are not conquered? It goes on to list all these lands which are not conquered. And actually, just in Pasuk Yud Beis, I just skipped a few psukim. In Pasuk Yud Beis, Moshe conquered the land of Og Melech HaLashon, but B'nei Yisrael were not able to conquer within that territory the area of Ma'acha and Geshur. Those are the kings of that area. Those are the fiefdoms of that area. Ma'acha and Geshur. There were two areas in the Bashan Hills. You want to actually see where those are, just to get a sense of what we're talking about here. Here we are. Take a look at the next figure 3. You take a look, it's interesting that to the right of the Kinneret, just to the right of the Kinneret, there's a little word which reads Geshurites with a question mark and Ma'achatites. That's what we're referring to over here. So it sounds like some part of the Bashan, some part of what we have as the Golan Heights today, still remained belonging to the Canaanite territorial leaders of that area. So it wasn't fully conquered till later on. Interesting historical footnote here is that when David HaMelech marries a number of wives, one of his wives, his fourth wife, is actually the daughter of the king of Geshur. That means to say that this is a conversion in marriage. And in fact, the child of that marriage is a very famous person, and his name was Avshalom. Wasn't such a good thing for David. In the end of the day, there is actually a debate whether she was an Eshet Sefas Torah, somebody that David met in war, from when he was fighting against Geshur. And ultimately, when Avshalom runs from David HaMelech, and there's a war against them, where does he go? He goes to Geshur, he goes to the Golan Heights, essentially. That's where he finds refuge, just to have a sense of what's going on. David HaMelech ultimately does vanquish this area and does control it, but it seems to be those little pockets still of kings which are left in this area that were unconquered. Okay, so this is as we go. So it sounds like a lot of Israel wasn't conquered, a lot of Israel was conquered. What wasn't conquered? So the map of the lack of conquest shows as follows. So if you take a look at the next map in figure 4, The darker areas in the north and the darker areas in the south are the two areas which are primarily not conquered. Do you see that? So the further north areas seem to be outstanding, and the Philistines by the Gaza area, Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gaza City, all those areas remain in the control of the Philistines. And those all in the coastal plains, because the Philistines had chariots, they couldn't get to the hills. That was why it was very difficult for them to conquer that area. This is all we have. Okay, so we're, at this point, we're all good. This is what we have. We seem to have most of the Golan Heights, a few strongholds still left, till Dawud al-Malik comes along. Before we get to Dawud al-Malik, there is one interesting episode that occurs, and that is that we have an episode at the end of Shoftim, where there's a tribe of Dan is going around, and Dan doesn't feel like they've got the requisite territory. They feel that they don't have enough space for their people. So instead of conquering the nations around them, there's a few Amorite kings still left. They're too difficult to conquer. They say, you know, we're going to go find a soft target. So they go up north, and they go to a place called Laish, and they go and conquer this place called Laish. It's a very famous episode. The reason why it's famous is because they take with them a shrine called Micha. Pesel Micha goes with them, and they establish it as a shrine there. Laish, where is Laish? Laish actually happens to be one of the cities in the Golan Heights. So Dan now extends their colonial territory to the area of the Golan Heights, conquering a little area pocket of Dan. And fun fact today is when you go to, where does the Jordan River fed from? Meaning like, where does all that water come from? There's a number of springs in the Golan Heights around the Hermon area. The biggest of those springs today is called Dan. It's because that was the territory where Dan actually conquered Laish. And that's where the Jordan River is fed from. It's one of the biggest natural springs in the world in terms of cubic volume of water, which is passing through it on a daily basis. Okay, so there seems to be a little micro conquest over here. Now, any questions, observations at this point? Because we're just getting there's not enough time to really go through all the circuit, but I just put a lot in here to see this. But let's just do a little further. Now, Dawud al-Malik comes into town. Dawud al-Malik takes over. He's able to quell the Philistines in the south. And when he's able to conquer the Philistines in the south, he starts his northern campaign. His northern campaign, he reaches out eastwards, he reaches out northwards. And in that campaign, he has a number of battles. He has one example of the battles in Shmuel Beis. He says, in 4:7, Dawud al-Malik is reaching up northwards, he conquers the king of Tzova. What city is Tzova? Any sardiots here today? Should know this. What city is Tzova? Which country you came from? Aleppo. Thank you. Good. So this is the Syrian country of Aleppo, and the Jews were there for millennia. This is one of the most historic places where Jews have been in the diaspora. Keter Aram Tzova, the Aleppo Codex, is the most ancient Jewish manuscript of the Torah, which is extant, came from Aleppo. So if Dawud al-Malik conquered Aleppo, you can only see how far north he's going into Syria today. So he has this huge conquest, conquers the chariots, destroys the horses, hamstrings the horses, and takes over the soldiers. And then he arrives at Damascus. Damascus. And Dawud al-Malik conquers another 22,000 soldiers. So at this point in time, Dawud al-Malik makes this huge push northwards. And just to appreciate how far north this is, we're deep into Syria, folks, right? We're really into Syria at this point in time. This is the expanded territory of Israel under Dawud al-Malik. Question is, halakhic status. What is the status of Dawud al-Malik's conquest? You'd say, well, Dawud al-Malik's the king, so he has the right to expand the boundary of Israel, right? So that would make a lot of sense, but not quite. The Gemara, there's a number of halakhic differences of this territory. The missions in Avodah Zarah talks about this, the Rashi talks about this, the Ram talks about this, and basically the line we get from the Gemara is the following, is that this area is what's considered called Kivush Yachid. What does that mean literally? Kivush Yachid means conquest of like a person, of an individual, as opposed to conquest of Kivush Rabbi, of a nation. Meaning even though Dawud al-Malik was the king, and even though Dawud al-Malik had the license to do so, we view this as a conquest which really wasn't fully licensed. Why? Because number one, Rashi says he didn't have a Navi telling him to do this. This was a battle of reprisal against the people who were fighting against him. And number two is it wasn't with the Rishus called Yisrael, whatever that means. It's hard to know what that means because Dawud al-Malik was controlling the armies, meaning he had a partial army. It wasn't like they were taking referendums in those days, right? So it's hard to understand what that means. But nonetheless, this wasn't considered as if the expansion of Israel with full license, and therefore it's called Kibush Yachid. What difference does that make? Answer is only one difference, and that is when you live in that area, it is considered Eretz Israel mit de Rabbanon, the land of Israel mit de Rabbanon. You say to yourself, why quibble? What does that make? Difference does it make? The answer is a very big difference. What's the difference between living in Israel and not living in Israel, halachically speaking, just like examples? Shemitah, Yovel, Orla, Truma, Maaser, all the halachas that relate to the land itself, right? Which we have the schus of doing when we go to the land of Israel. Good. So the thing is like this. So if I live in an area which Dominic have conquered, so let's say I go and buy a house in Damascus now. Not to be done right now. Right? Not exactly right now is the safest time to do it. But let's say I were to buy a house in the area of Damascus or Aleppo, which is considered the area that Dominic have conquered. In that case, then there would only be a din of Truma and Maaser, Midarabono. Okay, so I would only have to give Truma and Maaser on a level of Darabono, not on a Doraisa level. Makes some fascinating differences in halacha. Okay, that's all we have over here. So we have sort of, you know, the initial conquest of Yehoshua, and included that is some parts of the Bashan, some parts of the Golan. Then there's the expanded conquest of David HaMelech, which is seen as a secondary conquest, and now we have expanded territory. Unfortunately, doesn't last. We see if we carry on reading through Malachim, we're carrying on just rushing through history now. We see what happens is slowly but surely we have these people called the Assyrians, and they take away all this land. So there's a fellow called Tiglath-Pileser, and then Sargon, and then Sancheriv. All these folks, not a nice bunch of people, but we weren't so nice ourselves at the time. And we lost the tribes on the east bank first, and then the northern tribes of Naphtali and Manasseh, and then finally Shomron. It was all taken by the Assyrians. The nation of Israel was taken in primarily to exile, and finally after another almost century, we have the southern area of Yehuda taken into exile by the Babylonians. And that's the end of this. So what happened then? So was Israel after that? So what you say is, no, of course, Israel's always Israel, right? But halachically speaking, did Israel maintain being Israel when we were absent?
No.
The answer is no. We paskin, and this is based on Pesachim, Kidsha Rishana, Loi Kidsha V'Laz Dilavon. The first Kedusha, which means when Yeshua came to the land of Israel and he sanctified the land and it became Israel for all halachic purposes and spiritual purposes, that evaporated when they were conquered. And that was it. So you say, well isn't there Kedusha to the land today? The answer is, yes, of course there is. And that's because of what's called Kidusha Shnia, second Kedusha. When did that happen? What was happening then? So this is when the return, the Shivas Tzion. Who are some of the leaders of the Shivas Tzion, just to get some names out there? Actually, that was the second tier. Who was the first tier? Zerubbabel and Yehoshua Kohen Gadol. Fantastic. Okay, listen, ladies, it's all in Tanakh. It's all great stuff. Okay, so when we sing on, you know, we sing Maoz Tzur, we sing Zerubbabel. It's not a name for Babel. Zerubbabel was a Jewish leader. Okay, he is a sign of David. He's the great grandson of Yechoniah, who was exiled. Okay, so that's who was leading. He was a Persian citizen who was a Jew becoming the governor of the state of Judea under the Persians. Okay. That's what's called Second Commonwealth, Binyan Bayis Sheni. And under this date were Kidsha Shnia. How were they Mekadosh exactly? How did they make the land of Israel holy? No fighting, because the Persians did the fighting. The Persians controlled 127 states at this point in time. Ceremony, good. Anyone familiar what that looked like? Good, okay, good. Excellent, good. So this is exactly what happened. So it's described. They took the Sefer Torah, they took the Sanhedrin, they walked around the walls of Yerushalayim, and they declared this holy, and that became Kidsha Shnia. And the reason why when you go to Eretz Israel today, it is holy, is because that is a continuation of Kidsha Shnia, Kidsha La'asid Lavoi, even though they were exiled. Why do you think, just out of interest, why do you think it is that Kidsha Rishana, which seemed to be much more powerful, was ultimately reneged upon, was removed, whereas Kidsha Shnia stayed? Why do you think the difference is? I would have said the opposite, right? Yes.
Maybe by the first one, they had no choice, like that's where they were going. But by the second temple, like they made the choice to.
Great. Okay, excellent call. Rav Soloveitchik says a very similar thing. It's a really excellent point, and that is that if you think about this, most of the Jews in Babel did not come back. Okay, so just to give you numbers, okay? How many Jews came back to the land of Israel when Hashem said you can, allowed Koresh, Cyrus the Great, the Persian, to allow the Jews back? How many Jews came? 42,000 or so, okay? Plus, arguably, we're talking about less than 20% of the Jewish people at this point in time. Right? Most people said, look, we've got our kids in daycare, we've got our jobs, our cousins, our families, our tennis courts, our swimming pools, we're still paying the mortgage on the house. It's busy, right? It's hard. So therefore they said, you know what, we'll send a paycheck at the appeal time around Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, and you enjoy yourselves. We will support you and we will write letters and talk about you on Independence Day. Right? So unfortunately, by the way, there's a lot we can learn by reading about Shivas Tzion, which relates to today as well. But nonetheless, that means to say that every single person who decided to put the Israel t-shirt on and walk to Israel with Ezra and Nehemiah, or actually Zerubbabel and Yehoshua in the first round, had made a decision. That means to say they knew and they had decided they were going. This was voluntary and completely voluntary. So says Rav Soloveitchik, Kidsha Shnia was absolute passion. Absolutely every single person wanted to be there. That's maybe why it lasted longer. Another possibility as well And this is what the Rambam says, is just more simply, is that the first one is through what's called kivush. When you say, we brought our arms in, we brought our armies in, we conquered. Well, if you conquered it, you know what happens? Someone else can conquer it from you. So your investment in the land was through military, so it was retracted through military. Our second one was achieved not through military, but through mandates. The Persians controlled the area. They said, you Jews go over here, you can return to your natural homeland. And we did it. That's longer lasting. It's important to think about when it comes to the UN votes. When the nations say, this is it, right? That means to say there's a lot longer longevity, even on the level of halachic kedusha, than it is necessarily by conquest. Food for thought. Yes?
If there was no prediction there was Israel at the time of when they were exiled, then how come the one they all decided they wanted to go back there?
Oh, no, you're right. Technically speaking, it didn't exist there. That means to say that if I were there in that period of time, if I were one of those Jews with Gedalia, as an example, right, at that point in time, then would I have had to keep Shomer Maaseh in the same way? The answer is no. But of course, this is still the promised land. I mean, the mission is still on the wall, right? Avraham Avinu, we still haven't achieved the Kadmari kidneys, right? We have not really achieved that. We're waiting. But in terms of halachic kedusha, something has disappeared. Okay, so you know what? How to define it? A little more complicated. Yeah, okay.
But I mean, by the same logic, if you're saying that the second answer for salvation,
yes,
is if it was given this time by mandate, and like that was what determined, then the exact same thing could be said, that someone else gets mandate, someone else gets control, and the second that we lose that.
So I agree with you 100%, and it's a question I personally have, and I'm still not, I don't have a comfortable answer to it. Okay, so I don't fully understand. I understand why that is, because ultimately the Persian giving the mandate even was still dependent on the military conquest themselves. That's the issue I have. It sounds like that the mode of transmission, the mode in which Hashem facilitated this transaction, was not military. That's what it sounds like. Symbolically, that's what it sounds like. It is over here, is peacefully, you're going in, and lo barash, not with a noise, not with a fanfare, and sometimes things which will have a fanfare disappear in fanfares too. That's what it sounds like.
That it but if it's a peaceful mandate, then it would end as soon as that mandate ended, and it would have begun again with the UN vote.
You're right. So it doesn't sound like it is now still in flux up to that point. It sounds like it was given. So what happened? So where did they go, by the way? So how far did that territory go? Not so simple. Let's just do a quick look at this. Here's the map of what we have in, we're skipping a few maps here, but let's take a quick look over here in figure 8 for a second, okay? Here are the cities that we have in the second Beis Hamikdash, which are noted that the Jews are living around in the second Beis Hamikdash, okay? You'll see over here a lot of the circles with a lighter coloring in the middle are the ones from that I mentioned, Tanakh, Bechurun, Ramah, Michmash, Yerushalayim, right? But the darker ones are also ones which we find, maybe not mentioned, but we see in the Gemara in the times of the Mishnah, are there are Jews living there. So for instance, if you look over here, it actually leads up pretty far up. We don't have specific ones in the Golan which are matched over here, but close to it we have Gushato, Kadesh, right? We have places where the Jews were, in fact, living. So where did the mandate, where did the Second Commonwealth reach until? It's a little bit of a debate, but generally speaking, it's just below the Kinneret. We assume that it's just below the Kinneret to a place called Beit Shan. And if you can see it, there's just about a little further south of the Kinneret and not so far south. The reason it wasn't so expansive is because we weren't walking there as warriors. What did we do? We walked in there as, with our cap in hand, as we came over and took this land back from ourselves. So says the Ramban, that the Kid Shoshnia, Mida Oraisa, Eretz Yisrael is more limited based on the mandate we got from the Persians. But they maintained the extended areas, which was from Kivush Rishon by Yehoshua as Eretz Yisrael Mida Rabbanon, which is pretty much the status today. Now, it looks like we are 1 minute till our time, so let me just wrap up one longer perspective, and that is that there is a very fascinating debate in Halacha today, and there's a book Rabbi Israeli has on this topic, in which the discussion is what about the conquest of the Israeli army? So do you say that the conquest of the Israeli army does the same thing perhaps as maybe the conquest of David HaMelech, or the same thing as the conquest of the Kitcher Shni or not? It is a matter debated greatly in Halacha. But in the end of the day, most halachic authorities assume that we still maintain it as we hold on to the Kitcher Shneir, like the Rambam says, which is the Gezunt, which was the conquest of the Olei Bavel, the second tier round. It is worthwhile noting that even though that's true, we should remember that all of this came long before Islam or Christianity existed. Right? Let's just appreciate all of this stuff is all before any of these other religions were even thought of. To the extent that we have, if you go to the Golan today, you can visit the Gamla Museum. This is talked about in Josephus. It was one of the areas which the Chareshmonaim liberated from the Seleucid Greeks. You can see Gamla today. You can see where the Jews lived. We can recreate the town where they lived. I actually personally visited an area where there were ruins, and they found an intact slab of stone which said, Zeh beis medrashoy shel Rabbi Eliezer HaKapar. Meaning, Eliezer HaKapar, we read about in the Mishnah in Avos, we listen to his statements, we know where he lived, we know where he learned, we know where he taught. Where was that? It was in the Golan. So undoubtedly, whether or not, and we're skirting the issues of international law today, undoubtedly, when it comes to the question is, do we have an ancestral connection to here? Was this something taught about in the Torah and the Mishnah Goral? The answer is unquestionably yes. And I think it behooves us to appreciate our history before the rest of the world debates it in front of our eyes, to appreciate where we truly live. God willing, it should be clearer. It should be clearer to us, and it should be clearer to the world, the true homeland and the true places where we belong and hope to return to. Thank you, ladies. Thank you.
There are buses leaving.